Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a discussion of the bizarre politics of the state of Arizona, where tomorrow the remaining Republican presidential candidates will be holding a crucial debate before next Tuesday's Michigan and Arizona primaries. Rodolfo Espino, a professor of political science at Arizona State University, joins us to explain how a right-wing anti-immigrant sheriff running for Congress, who was exposed for threatening to deport his gay Mexican lover and has since outed himself, became the state co-chair of Mitt Romney's Arizona campaign. Then we will talk with David Brock, the founder and chairman of Media Matters and the author of a new book out today, The Fox Effect: How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. We will discuss the un-American phenomenon of a so-called news network that acts as the Ministry of Information for Republican administrations and the Pravda of the Republican Party, all the while posing as paragons of American patriotism. Then finally, we'll discuss the moral disconnect between the holier-than-thou religious agenda of Rick Santorum, Mitt Romney, and Newt Gingrich, who have all accused President Obama of waging a war on religion, while they themselves compete over who will be the first to bomb Iran. David Courtright, the Director of Policy Studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame, joins us to explain how apparently the sanctity of life and the defense of the unborn does not apply to the killing of thousands of people living in foreign lands. And joining us now is Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, specializing in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation, and the co-director of the Minority Language Assistance Research Project. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rodolfo Espino.
Thank you for having me.
And there's some fairly bizarre politics going on in your state, Arizona, on the eve of a very crucial debate which takes place tomorrow, Wednesday, the last chance the remaining Republican candidates have to make their case before the Arizona and Michigan primaries next Tuesday. It seems that the co-chair of Romney's Arizona campaign had to quit recently, and he was a sort of macho right-wing anti-immigrant sheriff who was exposed in the Phoenix New Times for threatening to deport his gay Mexican lover. And this apparently resulted in the sheriff, who had made campaign commercials with John McCain, walking along the border fence talking about the need to keep aliens out. So he then had to resign, but he outed himself. That's pretty much what happened, didn't he, in his press conference?
He came out that he is gay. And it was probably the shrewd, smart thing to do, rather than denying that. What he has been denying, however, is the fact that he used his position of power to threaten his lover. And he's claiming that those allegations are completely false and that he's going to press forward and continue his run for a newly created congressional House seat here in Arizona.
So he's certainly not dropping out. Now, Joe Arpaio, the notorious sheriff there, apparently was a friend of this sheriff. He's distanced himself from him, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. And it's not just Arpaio, but there's other Republican politicians in the state legislature that have criticized Sheriff Paul Babu, not so much for being gay, but more for his lack of judgment in posting pictures of himself, you know, with his shirt off in the bathroom, onto gay dating sites.
So this is it's okay to be anti-immigrant, to be a Latino basher, but you can't expose yourself on a gay website. That's the standard we're dealing with here, right?
Well, I guess the criticism more about the lack of judgment is what they're raising criticisms. It's not so much about being gay, but perhaps not using sane rational thinking, that you're in a position of influence, you're a high profile person, you probably should not be doing that because there's going to be significant backlash should this ever come out. The other thing, too, is the reason this has become newsworthy. I mean, I've spoken to various reporters here on the ground that have intimated that they have known about Paul Babu's background, that he is gay, that he has had this life that has sort of been secret and hush-hush. But the reason that nobody has made it public until now is that that in itself was not newsworthy. What is newsworthy, according to a lot of reporters, and the reason that the New Times broke the story, was his positioning as a hardcore border hawk, and then making these, having a gay Mexican lover and threatening this individual with deportation. And those are contradictory positions, and hence why we're hearing about it in the news.
So the other story here in Arizona, Rodolfo Espino, that preceded this, I'm sort of catching up on Arizona politics because we've spoken before, particularly around the time of SB 1080, the anti-immigrant bill that became law, and Governor Brewer proudly signed it into law. She, of course, made national headlines recently for wagging her finger in the face of President Obama, which seems to sort of indicate a pervasive disdain for the president and for the office of the presidency that's quite apparent in a lot of Republican circles. How has that played in the state?
Well, that particular incident has, I mean, you've heard some circles decrying that action as disrespectful towards the president, and not just the individual, but the office of the president. But there are also people that are applauding that governor. I've heard of images of the governor wagging her finger at the president being printed on T-shirts and sold at Republican functions. And so there's certainly a lot of individuals in Republican circles here in Arizona that don't have a lot of respect for President Obama and support the governor's actions. And I should point out that not everyone in Arizona, of course, is of that mindset, that there are individuals that have been harshly critical. And I think, that especially independent voters, according to some polling data, don't look favorably upon Governor Brewer's actions in disrespecting the office of the president in that fashion.
So, how does this the self-outing of the sheriff and his forced resignation as Governor Romney's Arizona co-chair? How's that playing in advance of these debates, this critical debate tomorrow night, Wednesday night in Mesa, Arizona? Now, Mesa is a fairly solid Mormon part of the state, isn't it? And that's the conventional wisdom, is that Romney has an advantage in Arizona because of the Mormon population.
Yeah. I mean, there's a heavy Mormon influence here in Arizona, as there is throughout the southwest of the United States. And that certainly, the Mormon connection certainly gives Romney some advantage. But, it's not a slam dunk for him, because there's some questions about his conservative credentials, and that certainly some of his candidates, Santorum and Gingrich, are going to be raising about whether he really is a strong conservative as he claims. Can we really trust a liberal Republican from Massachusetts? And this is something that we'll be hearing, because just as a backdrop, this area of Mesa, it's very Mormon, but it's also very conservative. It's the same area that has that saw Russell Pierce, the sponsor of the anti-immigrant legislation SB 1070 that you referenced earlier. He came from Mesa. He still resides in Mesa, and so there, there's a mix of Mormonism and some strong conservatism that Mitt Romney is going to, have to negotiate very carefully and really work hard on convincing voters out there that he is the staunch conservative that he's now claiming to be.
And the congressman from that district, Jeff Flake, is an interesting guy. He's a Mormon, but he's also been a champion of cleaning up money in politics and ending earmarks. He's running for the Senate, right? Kyle's is resigning, so there's an open Senate seat there in Arizona.
That's correct. Our junior senator, John Kyle, has announced that he won't be seeking re-election. Jeff Flake from the current Congressional District 6 has announced that he's going to be stepping down from his House seat and will be making a run for that Senate seat. Jeff Flake is Mormon and has the Mormon heritage that goes back generations here in Arizona. His family goes back to the pre-statehood here in Arizona. And he is, like you said, one of these individuals that has championed causes such as campaign finance, been against pork barrel spending. He might be what you might call the new maverick of Arizona. That distinction previously was held by John McCain prior to his run for the presidency in 2008. He was known as the maverick. So a lot of those things that you see Jeff Flake having been a champion of, or could also be easily associated with John McCain. But also prior to John McCain, Barry Goldwater, right? So you have this Arizona history tradition of a progressive Western mindset of, you know, keeping the federal government out of our backyard, and being reformist in ways of saying being anti-political party, anti-corruption. Again, just part of Arizona's politics that we see continuing to this day with Jeff Flake.
Well, of course, Rodolfo Espino, again, professor of political science at Arizona State University, where he specializes in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. The sheriff that we were referring to that was forced to out himself, he appeared in a campaign commercial with John McCain along the border fence, being anti-immigrant, applauding McCain for his stance against this sort of notion of this, you know, flood from the South. McCain has, of course, as we know, has had to tack way to the right and given up a lot of his maverick credentials. Much of it's traced, ironically, to his choice of Sarah Palin, surely, as his vice president. She's the sort of exemplar of the Tea Party.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of this, you know, a lot of people will point out that John McCain shifted right during this period, but you know, you can maybe trace it back actually not prior to 2008, actually to his 2000 run for the White House, in which he suffered a brutal Republican primary defeat in the South Carolina Republican primary. It was a dirty campaign. A lot of allegations were being raised. Rumors were being spread about him and his wife having a black baby, when in fact what they had just done was adopted a child from Bangladesh. But, you know, just because she was dark skinned, rumors were rampant in South Carolina that he may have had a black illegitimate child. And that's yeah. Something that probably deeply...
That was Karl Rove's work, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And mixed, of course, with traditional Southern politics there.
Mm. Well, Karl Rove is far... he favors Mitt Romney. He's now the Republican establishment, terrified of this wild card that's been unleashed by the Tea Party. And the Santorums and the Gingriches are his worst nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. And but, you know, it's interesting about... you look at this history going back to 2000 between McCain, Rove, and where they're at now. Karl Rove, of course, unleashed the dogs upon McCain, and McCain was someone that had once been associated with being friendly to immigration reform, friendly to the plight of Hispanic immigrants here. And after that, you never heard him, you never heard much of him talking about immigration reform. And it was probably something that came back to bite Karl Rove and the Republican Party, because the more that they pushed some of their contenders to the right, they lost a spokesman for, immigration reform in John McCain. And with that, you started losing the hearts and minds of Hispanic voters in the appeal of Republican primary to Hispanic voters. And this is something that Karl Rove was trying to work for in 2004, you know, appealing to the hearts and minds of Hispanic voters. But as they would attack anyone who was too centrist or too moderate on such issues as immigration, you would lose that Republican voice of sanity and reason for immigration reform. And with that, the hopes that you could build this permanent majority. And so you no longer hear McCain. You no longer even hear Lindsey Graham talking about immigration reform. And you look at the current crop of Republican primary nominees, each one is trying to outdo the other on being the tougher border hawk. And I expect to hear more of that in the Republican debate next week. And it's no surprise that we see these Republican candidates trying to court the likes of Sheriff Joe Arpaio and people associated with him so that they can be viewed by the Republican electorate as being tougher on the border than the next person.
But when you said next week, the debate's tomorrow night, isn't it?
Oh, I'm sorry, the debate's tomorrow night, but I was thinking of the primary, the actual...
Yeah, the vote is on Tuesday, right, yeah. So just in closing then, this you're more or less saying this thing's moved so far to the right that at what point does it move so far to the right with Governor Brewer being applauded for her disrespectful behavior towards the president? Does this give the Democrats an opening?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Democrats are sitting here and enjoying it because they know that the further right that the Republican primary nominees push themselves, the further away they're pushing themselves away from swing independent voters that are as a third of the electorate here in Arizona come the November general election. But more importantly, for a growing demographic group that I've already mentioned, Hispanics, right? We've seen the influence that Hispanics have wielded in California politics. The numbers aren't here yet in Arizona, but they will be in a decade or two. And the more that Republican Party pushes Hispanics away, the more they hurt their chances of continuing to control Arizona politics in a decade or two.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rodolfo Espino.
Sure.
Again, I've been speaking with Rodolfo Espino, who's a professor of political science at Arizona State University, where he specializes in American politics, racial politics, and political behavior. He's the editor of Latino Politics, Identity, Mobilization, and Representation, and the co-director of the Minority Language Assistance Research Project. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with David Brock about his new book on Fox News.
Time to send someone away. I've got my back covered. Said, how you been all led astray? Come, let's count its up soon. They lead you to the race, but no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Brock, the founder and chairman of Media Matters and the author of five books, including The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media, and How It Corrupts Democracy, and his best-selling memoir, Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. His new book, just out today, is The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Brock.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on.
And when Fox began, Rupert Murdoch, do you think he did, and he because hired Roger Ailes, was he motivated by a business decision? In other words, I'm going to carve out the kind of right-wing niche in this country, or was it a purely ideological decision?
Well, I think on Murdoch's part, they saw a commercial opportunity. And the original idea for Fox and what it actually looked like in until fairly recently was the model was bringing conservative talk radio to television. And so that is a model they followed for some years. What we document in the book is a change really since 2008 in which the network begins to look much more like a partisan political operation than any kind of journalistic institution and operates, in fact, I think you could argue, does a better job than the Republican National Committee in terms of raising money, putting out the Republican message, and also mobilizing conservative grassroots.
And in terms of Roger Ailes, of course, he came from the highest levels, if you will, of Republican circles. He was a media consultant for Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, and George H.W. Bush with little journalistic experience, and the results speak for themselves. But I'm surprised in many ways that the argument is not made against what they do because, you know, they've confiscated the flag and taken the patriotic high ground, which is pretty much how right-wingers operate in this country. The assumption is that they're patriotic and liberals are somehow, you know, if they're not agents of a foreign power, they're lily-livered in terms of their patriotism. The long and the short of it is that, you know, I used to work on the Cold War. I spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union, and we would often meet with reporters of TASS and Pravda, and a lot of them were KGB, but a lot of them were just journalists who were basically told what to say by the government. And it seems to me so deeply un-American that you would have a television network that would be the voluntary Ministry of Information for a sitting government, or a political party in this case. In other words, Fox is the Pravda of the Republican Party, and it seems to me shameful and un-American.
Well, sure. Let me say a couple things about that. Number one, I think that we show in this book that Roger Ailes had a plan dating from the early 1970s to put the GOP on television. And there was references to that in exchange of memos between Ailes and other people in the Nixon White House. There was an attempt by Joseph Coors to fund such a network in the early 1970s. It failed, but I think Ailes never, even though he continued in his career in politics, I think he never gave up on that idea. And since President Obama came into office, when Ailes declared that moment to be the Alamo, and they've really waged a war against the administration. And as I mentioned earlier, they've taken on all of the attributes of a partisan political operation. We show in the book, according to a study we did at Media Matters, you had 30 Fox employees, both on the air and off the air, in sort of co-branded Fox-type events around the country, raising more than $50 million for Republican and conservative causes. So Fox becomes a money machine, and candidates know it. Brown in Massachusetts, Sharon Angle in Nevada. We're getting blanket news coverage where they were openly soliciting funds. Secondly, on message, we've traced, and this can be somewhat embarrassing or even comical, but we've traced some examples where Fox, in its Fox Facts or talking points that they put up on the air or in their chyroning, they're copying verbatim from Republican National Committee and Republican press releases and websites. In one case, down to repeating a typographical error. That's how much they were copying the message. And then I think the third thing, which is also new, is this idea that they can mobilize the conservative base. And what we saw in April 2009, where Fox ran before the Tea Party protests materialized, Fox was running, you know, more than 100 free commercials promoting these events around the country where their hosts were staked out around the country. And it's becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy when you have, under the false guise of journalism, you have a network out there promoting news events and then covering them as if they had no role in actually producing them. And so I think altogether, what you're saying about this being a kind of Republican National Committee on steroids and it being unprecedented and it having really a bad, I think, effects on our democracy is all in the book and is all correct.
David Brook, you were a Republican operative, and you wrote about your experience and your epiphany, if you will, in Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. And it's pretty logical, isn't it, that the Republicans, in order to get elected, have to get Democratic votes, and they have to peel off the blue-collar working-class guys, the so-called Reagan Democrats. And that seems to be what Fox has done on steroids. You know, you've got these faux populists like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, these multimillionaire guys pretending to be good working class stiffs. And essentially, they just throw out all kinds of red meat and extraneous, you know, obscure stories about some lesbian academic statement in some obscure university that nobody's ever heard of. And they build that up into a national story. Do you think, though, that they've been too successful? After all, they championed the Tea Party, and the current dysfunction now with the Republican race brings into stark contrast this dilemma where you've got the fired-up, base, and then you've got the Republican establishment realizing that the party's on a suicidal path.
Right. Well, so I think that's right. I mean, first of all, Fox does use phony and trumped up cultural kind of wedge issues to activate that Reagan Democratic base. For example, the war on Christmas that they claim is going on in the country that actually isn't, where they take a small incident and rip it out of context, or in fact just manufacture it to create the idea that there's all this anti-Christian sentiment in the country.
And the current war on religion. I mean, the current war on religion, surely.
Sure,
which is
absolutely.
Their latest.
The use by Fox of race. To divide the country. This is something that is a subtext in a lot of the stories, trumped-up stories about voter fraud, for example, or the Shirley Sherrod incident that folks will remember, where they used a doctored tape. And so you have all that going on. And then I think the point about the Tea Party is right, that there's a kind of irony here, which I was referring to a little earlier with this Fox primary, the irony being that they may, you know, be careful what you wish for. And I think some of the chaos in the Republican Party and how it at least appears to be, you know, falling apart to some extent is directly traceable to what Fox did, both politically and to drive its audience back in 2009 and 2010, that some of the seeds of the confusion now in the Republican field were planted by Fox itself.
So do you think Roger Ailes is getting an earful? I mean, I thought that he and Murdoch were you know, prided themselves on being Republican kingmakers, and Republicans are much more pragmatic about power. They don't, let ideological inconsistencies get in the way of their determination to be take over the levers of power. And they're in a pretty good shape in terms of taking over the Senate, in terms of the numerical advantages they have. I don't know whether they can hold on to the House, but they certainly want the White House, and they're almost obsessed and irrational in their hatred of Obama. Roger Ailes could be blowing it all for them, right?
Right. I think it's possible. I think that, you know, there's some division likely in Fox itself. You have a figure like Karl Rove, who's a Fox News contributor, who clearly representing more of the conservative Republican establishment has seemingly always been for Romney. There's no question that the Fox audience was cheering on folks like Bachman, folks like Herman Cain. You even saw in some polling Fox audience preferences in some of the early primaries, never getting behind the front runner Romney. So there are unintended effects here, and I certainly don't think that in the primary process, Fox is necessarily kingmaker. I think where their role comes in is once the primary is settled, as you suggested, ramping up the attacks on President Obama. And I think we'll feel the full force of that as Fox and the Republicans try to get back the White House.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment continuing the conversation with David Brock, the author of the brand new book, The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with David Brock, the founder and chairman of Media Matters and the author of five books, including The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media, and How It Corrupts Democracy, and his best-selling memoir, Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. His new book, just out today, is The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. Now, in terms of Ailes' own delusions of power, which obviously he has some real power and he has changed the political landscape in this country, arguably to its detriment, but he apparently has almost as much security as President Obama. Who does he think is out to get him?
Well, it's been reported, at least in one instance, that he has felt that gay rights activists were out to get him. I don't think security would be necessary to ward folks off. But, you know, there are legitimate concerns that people would have with Fox News content. And, you know, the way we document that here at Media Matters is to, you know, to put on our website both fact checks and also incidents of some of the more incendiary comments and offensive comments that come out of the Fox News channel. And we are trying to mobilize folks against the misinformation that comes out of Fox News, but there's no, I don't think there's any implied or certainly no direct threat that anybody's aware of. There's just concern out there.
So your brand new book just out today, The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. It has lots of transcripts of leaked audio and memos from the Fox reporters and executives, which it would indicate to me that there's some conscience there in terms of journalistic professionals appalled by the naked kind of Joseph Goebbels-like agenda that's being foisted on them by Roger Ailes. I mean, did they just adopt this fair and balanced thing in the deepest and most cynical Orwellian idea? Is that the idea that, you know, it's the big lie theory, right?
Right. No, I think that's right. And I think that was intentional on Roger Ailes' part. But what we've proven in the book, which I think is, you know, proved for the first time, that it is conscious and that it is intentional in terms of distorting and skewing the news. We do have memos that leaked out of the Fox News channel where the Washington, D.C. bureau chief is instructing the news staff how to distort when they're reporting on things like healthcare. He writes in one of the memos to never use the term public option, but to use the term government option. And Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster and wordsmith, had previously been on the record saying that whenever you put government attached to a phrase, it decreases people's favorability toward it. So they were clearly trying to play a political role there. Another memo on climate change instructs the news department to introduce skepticism and introduce the false notion that their scientific community is quite divided on the issue. And so you have all those cases where we've now documented and seen it, that people are being instructed. And then we've shown in our own monitoring of the program that this actually does happen, that the memos are followed and have an effect. You're also right that there's dissension within Fox News. Obviously, there are folks who've talked to us. There are some Fox executives. There are these leaks. There was one correspondent, Major Garrett, who by most accounts was actually a real reporter who left seemingly as an act of conscience. And so you do have pockets of conscience and dissension in there. It's just that the people running the show are running the show.
So, David Brock, how does the Fox then recruit these Democratic quislings that they have on, who are cast as Democrats to give them their illusion of fair and balance, but their main job is to attack the Democratic Party from within, if you will, and they're pretty sort of shameless, and it's pretty obvious. You know, the woman that ran Dukakis' campaign, Susan Estridge, and Alan Combs, of course, is almost typecast as the kind of weak, lily-livered liberal. And there's another guy that's a Democratic strategist, Bob somebody or other, I can't remember his name now.
Beckel.
Bob Beckel, exactly. Yeah. Do you have any idea of what makes those kind of people tick and why they haven't been pulled over and why the Democratic Party hasn't repudiated them? Because they really are, to use the old KGB phrase, useful idiots.
Yeah, well, this has been a source of, be right to say, frustration on the part of Fox critics like Media Matters, that they do enable the network to show, if not fairness, to show balance. And so in some of the counting surveys one would do, you would see that they do book a number of their own in-house Fox Democratic contributors. There are two types, which I think you touched on. One would be the Democrat who adopts conservative positions, and so is essentially a Democrat in name only, and that would be somebody like a Pat Caddell, who's on fairly frequently. And then the other, as you suggested, were the weaker Democrats who come across as not skilled in debate, not tough, and they're there for the effect that Alan Colmes used to be there for. They're there as punching bags. And there's an element, I think, in the Fox audience that likes to see the conservative, the O'Reilly, the Hannity, as the bully. And the Democrat is playing the role, you know, of the person who's abused by this. And so I think that's essentially the setup. It's hard to get inside the minds of the people who allow themselves to be used, but it is known. I mean, Fox is very generous with what it pays its contributors. And so some of this is obviously just bought and paid for.
So what do you think then is the answer, if you will, in terms of real fairness and real balance? One of the problems that I see in the way the effect that Fox has had on our national discourse is that we are reaching a point now in this country where the truth doesn't matter. He who manipulates and spins the truth wins the argument, and that we have this phenomenon now of reality shopping, where conservatives get their reality from Fox, Christians get their reality from Christian broadcasting, progressives get their reality from MSNBC, and so on. And we're in a point where there's a dangerous lack of consensus about what is true, and that the fairness and balance model, which has pervaded journalism and journalistic schools, this idea that in the universe of discourse there are two black and white opinions and they're equal and opposite, this has led to creationism being equated with evolution. It's led to the denial of global warming because, after all, that's just another opinion, and so on. And I'm sort of in despair about whether or not we're going to survive as a country when the truth matters less and less.
Well, I think that's right, and I think Fox is not solely responsible for this, but I think in large measure it certainly is. You referenced, you know, my time in the conservative movement. I got out of the conservative movement before Fox really became the prominent force that it is in the Republican Party. What David Frum probably said it best when he said, you know, we used to think that Fox worked for us, and now we all work for Fox. And the division and the polarization that's part of their model has created, I think, division and polarization in the country. They've created a counterfactual kind of universe. Anybody who knows, has friends or relatives who watch Fox News, would be familiar with the phenomenon whereby you can't agree on the basics. You can't agree on the basic facts, and so that leads to a situation where the country often looks ungovernable. You can't have progress on climate legislation when a substantial part of the public is being told that there's no problem. You can't have Republicans participate in the effort to reform health care when their constituents are being told that there are death panels. And so, yeah, I think it's a very serious problem for democracy. I think you have misinformed people who are making misinformed choices on policy, making misinformed choices in the voting booth. The most recent survey that I saw showed that people who don't watch the news are more informed than people who watch the Fox News channel. And so it is a very serious problem. It's a problem for progressives, but I think the more important problem is that it's a problem for the proper functioning of democracy, and they are brazen, and they go about this with every intention of misinforming.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, David Brock.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with David Brock, the founder and chairman of Media Matters and the author of five books, including The Republican Noise Machine, Right-Wing Media, and How It Corrupts Democracy, and his best-selling memoir, Blinded by the Right, The Conscience of an Ex-Conservative. His new book just out today is The Fox Effect, How Roger Ailes Turned a Network into a Propaganda Machine. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Rick Santorum and others' moral inconsistency.
No, I don't want to start a flame in your heart. No, I just want to set the world on fire.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Courtright, an American scholar and peace activist. He's the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And in 1978, he was named the executive director of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which under his direction became the largest disarmament organization in the United States. He then initiated a merger of Sane and the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. His recent books are Towards Nuclear Zero and Ending Obama's War. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Courtright.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
And in as much as you've written about ending Obama's war, it does seem at least if Afghanistan is Obama's war, obviously he inherited it, but he said he could do a better job, and now he's apparently pulling out. But it does seem, in terms of the people who want to take, who want Obama's job, the Republicans running for president, all of them seem to be stepping over each other to have a war with Iran.
It's quite crazy. They're the most hawkish bunch you could ever imagine, and they're just making these outrageous statements and threatening Iran, and no one seems to be commenting upon it in the press. So.
Well, but at the same time that they're calling for a war with Iran, they're also, at least in terms of Santorum and Gingrich, are also moralizing about their faith and in suggesting that Obama, in the case of Rick Santorum's aide, said that he has a radical Islamist agenda. So they question Obama's faith, but at the same time, they're sort of, you know, being holier than thou about their own faith. So, again, is there anybody calling them on the inconsistencies about Christian dogma? And I'm not sure anywhere in the Bible, I know there's quite a lot of blood in the Old Testament, but I'm not sure that Jesus Christ was about killing thousands of people in foreign lands.
No, exactly. And for these candidates, they seem to confine their notion of religiosity to questions about birth control and abortion, but never care to address the very strong ethical, moral teaching that is within Christianity against killing, against war. In the Catholic tradition, there's a very strong sense that war is unjust. It's always considered evil, even when it may be necessary to protect the innocent in certain limited circumstances. War is a sin, and it is never to be considered something that we are supporting or that we would do on our own voluntarily, only under necessity. So the religious teaching of Christianity and the core message of the Christian gospel is overwhelmingly oriented towards alternatives to war. Turn the other cheek. Give the coat in addition to your cloak. And all of these teachings are designed to suggest that we should look for other ways to solve our problems, not through war and killing, but through discussion and through dialogue and trying to care for the needy and the downtrodden. So all of these kind of messages are not there, and yet they claim to be Christian. It's totally alien to what most of us understand to be the real Christian message.
Again, I'm speaking with David Courtright, an American scholar and peace activist. He's the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And a part of this so-called issue that I think is largely a fraudulent issue that Fox News and others are ginning up, and that's the idea that President Obama is waging a war against religion.
That's preposterous, actually. You know, and of course we know from his background that, you know, he, when he was a community organizer in Chicago, he worked with the churches, and actually one of the first programs that he received financial support for in terms of his organizing activities was from a Catholic charity organization. So he's very connected to the church. And when he came to Notre Dame in 2009, when he was first elected, he gave a tremendously eloquent and powerful speech, which was well received by the graduates and by the large crowd that was there. And our president here, Father John Jenkins, was very courageous and stood his ground in saying that it's proper for a great university to invite the president, and it's an honor that he would come. and that we're open to listening to what he has to say. So there is a close understanding that President Obama has of the Catholic community because of his own community organizing work there in Chicago and because of his own understanding of Christianity and his genuine faith.
But when one of Rick Santorum's top aides refers to the president having a radical Islamic agenda, just sort of tossing it off as though that was an accepted fact, today on MSNBC, Franklin Graham, the son of the famous evangelist Billy Graham, also questioned not just Obama's Christianity, but suggested that he may well be a Muslim. And as you know, Donald Trump, another would-be Republican candidate, made that a centerpiece that Obama has a fake birth certificate, I guess implying that somehow he was born in Kenya. The what explains the lack of moral sanctions against just outright lies?
Yeah, it's very disturbing that these kinds of outrageous statements can be made by prominent public figures and no one gets called on it. It's unfortunately, I guess, a reflection of our media age that one can say almost anything and get away with it. But it also, I think, reflects a strong bias against Obama by many of these major news organizations, certainly Fox Television, there's no secret about that, and many of these right-wing Christian evangelical organizations have been adamantly opposed to Obama and to Democratic policies, Democratic Party policies in general for many years. They could almost be seen as fronts for the Republican Party, and really even not just the Republican Party, but the right wing of the Republican Party. So it's a reflection of how our society has been distorted by the dominant influence that these voices have. And they seem to be especially significant in matters related to Israel and then Israel's great fear of Iran. And so these evangelical Christian organizations are in some cases very strongly Zionist in the very right-wing interpretation of that concept and are more than willing to see any kind of criticism of Obama for not being supposedly strong enough in supporting Israel, whereas in fact the administration's policies have been, I would say, overly supportive of the Netanyahu government, of these right-wing policies that the current Israeli government is advocating. So it's really politically motivated when you get right down to it, in my opinion, and has nothing to do with Christianity, that's for sure, or of any genuine interpretation of religious teaching on these important ethical issues.
Well, David Cartwright, there's a real fear, and this has been expressed by the Secretary of Defense and by the Pentagon itself and by the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that they have no guarantees that Israel will not strike Iran. Panetta said recently to the Washington Post that they're afraid that it could happen in the spring or the summer. It's certainly not off the table. And it raises this question about nuclear proliferation, the idea that Iran is seen as a great threat by a country, Israel, that has up to 200 nuclear weapons. Obviously, if Iran does get nuclear weapons, that would probably stimulate the Saudi Arabians. They probably would just simply buy one from Pakistan. Pakistan, of course, is almost a failed state and yet has the fastest growing nuclear weapon arsenal on the planet. They've just surpassed France and, I believe, England in their numbers of nuclear weapons. So into this, and of course, you headed up the SANE Nuclear Committee for a SANE Nuclear Policy, and then you eventually merged that SANE with the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign and have written a recent book, Towards Nuclear Zero. Obviously, there's always been a problem on the part of the United States in terms of preaching non-proliferation, because we have thousands of nuclear weapons and we consider other countries getting them to be unacceptable, in particular in this case, Iran. There's some indications that President Obama is entertaining a radical reduction in nuclear weapons. Are you following that?
Yes, and I think you're right, first of all, about the inconsistency and one might even say hypocrisy of our nonproliferation policy, that we cling to still thousands of these weapons. We give a complete pass to Israel, which, as you say, has 200 nuclear weapons, and are applying all of this pressure and even these veiled military threats against Iran, when Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. This has been confirmed many times by our own top U.S. intelligence agencies and by the U.N. international inspectors. It does have a nuclear program. It could conceivably build a nuclear weapon after some effort of maybe a year or two or more, but it does not have a nuclear weapon. So we need to have a consistent policy. And the way we are having it now is we're trying to tell everyone else to get rid of the weapons while we cling to them. It's like, you know, you can't preach temperance from a bar stool. You know, you have to give up the drink yourself and be consistent in opposing these weapons among all players. President Obama has been, I think, quite progressive and made some important contributions in trying to reduce nuclear weapons and in highlighting the goal of a world without nuclear weapons. And this is quite unprecedented. President Reagan and Bush the First did negotiate significant reductions in strategic nuclear weapons with the old Soviet Union. But President Obama is the first president to really try to highlight this goal of getting rid of these weapons entirely. We haven't made much progress in that direction, but we're making a little bit. And the news reports that the Pentagon and the White House are considering further significant reductions, and that some have talked about that we could go down to just a couple hundred weapons and still be completely secure in the nuclear sense in terms of being able to deter any nuclear attack. That's very encouraging. And actually, some of us who've been studying these issues over the years have been saying exactly this for, you know, actually decades, that instead of the 30,000 that we used to have and the 3,000 or 4,000 that we still have now, we could go down to a couple hundred and still be within the logic of a nuclear deterrence policy. And once we got to that level, it would be great progress. It would be a wonderful day for our government's policy. And once we got to that level, then we could begin to seriously work down towards zero in partnership, of course, with other countries. So that they're considering these steps is good news, and let's hope that they actually begin to implement some of them.
Well, just in closing, David Courtright, just to return to the discussion of the moralizing that's now going on in the Republican primaries, particularly with Rick Santorum. And it raises questions not about what he talks about, freedom of religion and in terms of the First Amendment, but the way that he's talking about homeschooling and not having a prenatal screening for women and not having contraceptives available to women almost raises the question of that we need freedom from religion, in as much as he seems to be imposing his values and on the rest of us, and that's what he expects us to live like he does. Again, it raises this fundamental question when they're talking about so aggressively about attacking Iran in terms of the nuclear issue and reducing the arsenals. It's always struck me, you know, particularly during the Cold War, this incredible misapplication of priorities, that we were refining the redundancy of death at the expense of the quality of life. And that's always been inherent in our enormous amount of defense spending, which, of course, we almost outspend the entire world combined in terms of defense spending. Again, I don't see these pro-life people pointing out how much our policies are pro-death.
Well, that's a very good point. And again, if you look at the teaching of the Catholic bishops of the Vatican, look at the teachings of the major Protestant and other Christian denominations, they've been consistently advocating that we need to reduce military spending, that our military posture and our nuclear weapons postures are not only immoral in the sense that they kill or threaten to kill thousands, tens of thousands, even millions of people if we were to ever use nuclear weapons, but they are a theft from the poor. They divert resources, precious economic resources that are needed to uplift the needy and those who are less fortunate in life, and instead divert those resources to mechanisms of death and destruction and to these giant corporations that are already super rich and that are benefiting further from these excessive and unnecessary military expenditures. These candidates who advocate these kinds of positions and claim to be Christians are truly hypocrites, in my view. This is not anything like Christianity or any form of actual religious commitment. All the great faiths talk about the need to help the needy in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the idea of justice and mercy and compassion, especially for the needy and the downtrodden, and that we are required by our faith, if we're serious about it, to help these people and to commit ourselves to prevent violence and war. So these are the true values of religion and of Christianity, and what we're hearing from the candidates is hypocrisy. It's a politicization of religion, actually. They claim that the Muslim extremists use the religion to exploit people, and partly that's true, but we seem to hear similar kinds of messages from our own candidates who claim to be so religious, but in fact are using their religion to articulate an extremist position and one that is directly intended to undermine progressive policies from the Obama administration and from other political supporters of these kinds of policies to help the poor and to work against war and against nuclear weapons.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, David Courtright.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Courtright, an American scholar and peace activist. He's the director of policy studies at the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. And in 1978, he was named executive director of the Committee for a Sane Nuclear Policy, which under his direction became the largest disarmament organization in the United States. He then initiated the merger of Sane and the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. His most recent books are Towards Nuclear Zero and Ending Obama's War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.